I had the privilege of meeting Father Dietz at the last round, the 16th, of the Roman Catholic and Lutheran National Dialogue at San Antonio. And I was delighted to get the information that he was able to give us about the developing ecumenical situation in Sweden, and asked if it would be possible for him to come and talk to some interested people in St. Louis. We're happy that you are the interested people. Father Dietz is American-born, Moline, Illinois. He has a distinguished record in his order, the OMI, was their professor of systematic theology at the Scholastica at Pass Christi, Mississippi. In addition to that, he has everything that comes in the way of perquisites from having completed his work at the Gregorian University. But the thing that makes him of particular interest to us here tonight is the fact that ever since 1966, when the... 64, when the Ecumenical Commission was established under Bishop John Taylor, the American-born Bishop of Stockholm, who incidentally, as many of you probably know, has 17 different languages functioning within his diocese. He can't have a clergy conference, I understand, because there is no lingua franca now that Veterum Sapientiae has sort of lost out somewhere in the shuffle and turned out to be not infallible after all. The best that they can do is apparently to have little overlapping conferences in which they can manage. In this situation, Father has been the pastor of the Church of Our Lady in Stockholm and has been on the board of the League for Christian Unity and has been Bishop Taylor's man, not only in the sense that he accompanied him to the last two sessions of Vatican II, but also in that he has been the right-hand man of Bishop Taylor in the very interesting ecumenical situation that has been developing in Sweden. And that's what we should like to have you talk to us about tonight, Father, if you will, please. Father Dietz.
I don't really know if I've ever met anyone from the Missouri Synod until I met Professor Peepcorn. And I must say, I had always heard in Sweden that the Missouri Synod, they are very strict. And I was really pleased to meet Professor, and he's been very friendly to me and very warm. And he led a prayer service at the meeting in San Antonio and was kind enough to lead it from the Swedish portion of the prayer book. And I could see that he's a man of great devotion, of prayer, and also of great learning. And just from his kindness, from contact with him, I have a whole other idea of people in the Missouri Synod. I don't know why I should have had such a notion that they were very strict and formal from before, but anyhow, it was there deep down in my subconscious. So I'm happy to be here with you, and speak with you about ecumenism in Sweden. I don't know how acquainted you are with Swedish church life, so in the beginning, I would just like to describe the background of church life in Sweden. We could speak of the big three or the big four churches in Sweden, but really there's one church that's most significant, and that is the Lutheran Church, the state church. When you first go to Sweden, you contact that church in different ways. For one thing, you find in every small town one big, beautiful church, many times an old medieval church, and that church is usually the most prominent building in the city or the village. And it dominates. It's the most prominent building, and it dominates the city or village. And that's the Church of Sweden, or the State Church. And when you go into that town, if you're residing in Sweden, you're going to live there, you have to go to the police, and then you must report to the Lutheran pastor, and you must be inscribed in the parish, no matter what religion you belong to. And so you begin to come into contact with this this big phenomenon, this big reality in Swedish life, which is the Lutheran Church, the so-called Swedish Church. The Swedish Church is a reality that I've come to know and love. It's a very varied reality. I love their theology, I love the people that belong to it, many of the ministers. I can't say that I always understand it, and there are many opinions and theories among the members of that church itself as to its value and its situation. I think we have to say this, that for the last 450 years, for most of that time, it has been the body through which the Holy Spirit has worked in people's lives in Sweden. There was for a long time no other Christian body there. No other Christian body was allowed by law. And so the Holy Spirit used this organism, this body, this church, to help people to come into contact with Christ and the Father and the Holy Spirit. And we cannot deny that the Spirit has been there, and that Christianity has developed mainly and during the last 400 years in the Swedish Church, in the Lutheran State Church. So that's the big church. It takes in about 97% of the 8 million Swedes. As a matter of fact, if you're born a Swede, if you're a Swedish citizen, you are automatically a member of the State Church. You do not have to be baptized. So it's really bound up with the state. And that's why it's called the Swedish Church, the Church of the Swedish people. And the idea is that they are to make the grace of Jesus available, present, for all the people living there. That's kind of their theology, that they're open. And they embrace all the people. And they extend this grace of Jesus to all. Well, that's the big church, and that's the, you could say, the powerful church, the rich church, the numerically great church in Sweden, and the church with, in the last 400 years, where Christianity has developed. In opposition to the, or in distinction from the state church, are the three churches. And among these churches, there are two of significance, of two really large and strong churches. And the one is the Mission Covenant Church, and the other is the Pentecostal Church. The Pentecostal Church is very vibrant, and there are these two churches, as all the other free churches like Methodists and Baptists, which are quite small. These churches stress faith, that it's not enough just to be born into the church or to be baptized, to be sacramentally incorporated into the church as children, but to be a member of the church, one must believe, one must profess or decide for himself to belong to the church. So that's kind of their main stance, the three churches. And in that you have the Mission Covenant, which is a really basically a Lutheran church, but insisting on faith and on active participation on the part of the members against passivity in membership of the church. Because in Sweden there is a great deal of passivity. We have probably the lowest church attendance of any country in the world. I think it's under 3% over the whole country. In Stockholm, under 8.8% of 1%. And the big city is setting the trend for the rest of the country. So these people stress that you have to really be an active member. So this is kind of the picture, the church picture in Sweden. On the one hand, the state church, a very strong church numerically and historically, the church where Christianity has developed. And then you have the smaller but active and vital free churches, Mission Covenant and Pentecostal Church, as well as all the other so-called free churches, free in the sense that they're not state churches. And then you have some newcomers, and in one case, a newcomer that has been there before, and that is the classical churches, the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. In the case of the Catholic Church, the church that has been there before, that came with St. Ansgar in 800 and that developed throughout the Middle Ages up to the time of the Reformation. These churches, the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, are mainly immigrant churches. We've had a great influx of immigrants, especially since the end of World War II. In Sweden, the Catholic population at the end of the war was something like 7,000, mostly Swedish and intellectuals, intellectuals and artists. And then we had this wave of immigration from Poland, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Germany, especially countries behind the Iron Curtain, people that came to Sweden to work because there were not enough people to man the factories in expanding Swedish industry. And so these people came and they swelled the ranks. Many Turks. We now even have Mohammedans. So this country that once was very monolithic religiously, where there was just one church, the state church, the Lutheran church, suddenly began to experience many different faiths. And the Catholic Church became the fourth largest church in Sweden. Today we have 65,000. We're probably up to 100,000, though we don't know where our Catholics are, and they very often do not know where we are. Said that very often the church structure you see in Sweden is one big church, and that's the state church. Well, our churches, Catholic and Orthodox, are most often a living room or some kind of factory, that is a small factory taken over, or a garage that has been remade. So we're immigrants to the main and workers. So, and we have these tensions of different nationalities, and also the tension between our immigrants who are workers and our Swedes who are highly intellectual and artistic and people are very often of renown in the country. And so that's our situation. Well, and the Orthodox too, though they have very few Swedes in their church. So this is the religious picture in Sweden. The state church, then the free churches like Mission Covenant, the Lutheran Church, Pentecostal Church, and then the classical newcomers, the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. So now I'd like to more or less get into the development of ecumenical activity in Sweden. Certainly the big factor as far as Catholic and Lutheran contacts came was Vatican II. Up to that time, the Catholics in Sweden had really lived more or less isolated. And there was, you know, in Sweden, this great ecumenist, Archbishop Sederblom, who began a life and work and who meant so much to the ecumenical movement and who had invited the Catholics, and they said no. And he complained that while Paul came, that is, the Protestants came, and John came, the Orthodox came, Peter stayed home. The Roman Catholics didn't come. And so now, with Vatican II, it seemed as though something new was going to happen. Peter was deciding to go along with this ecumenical movement, and it was going to make a difference. It was going to create a new situation. There was an observer at Vatican II from Sweden, Bishop Sven Silén of Västerås. He did not go in the name of the Swedish bishops, the Lutheran bishops. There are 13 bishops, one of whom is the Archbishop of Uppsala. There were feelers out as to how they wanted to be represented, but they didn't feel that they wanted that kind of contact. They preferred to go as a representative of the Lutheran World Federation. So that's how he went. And at the end of the third session, when the decree on ecumenism was going to be promulgated, Bishop Silén wanted to have an ecumenical service as kind of a harbinger of the future, of what was going to happen in Sweden. And unfortunately, Bishop Taylor had to leave, and so he asked me to have this service with Bishop Silén. It was in the room of St. Bridget in Rome. and she is the most remarkable Christian personality in Swedish history, lived during the 1300s. And there in that room where St. Bridget lived and died, was really a very interesting and inspiring moment. Bishop Silane led this ecumenical service. There were the sisters there of St. Bridget, Catholic sisters. There were people from the Swedish embassy, and we had our first ecumenical service, and he spoke very warmly of what should come in Sweden. That was 1964, November 20th. And so since that time, there have developed gradually contact and a real cooperation and friendship between Catholics and Lutherans, between the state church and this new, this church of immigrants and Swedes, this Catholic church with all its variety. The two big factors in ecumenical work, in the ecumenical expansion or development in Sweden, I would say, was first the Catholic Ecumenical Commission. There were five members. There was a Swedish Benedictine and a German-Swiss Jesuit who was the head of it, and a French Dominican, and a Swedish lay professor from Uppsala, and myself. And we gathered together in 1966. That was right. I thought you were talking about when I went to Sweden. But we gathered together, and we would try to figure out ways of creating contacts. And much as Bishop Silane had prayed that there would be a lot of contacts, we found that now Paul was not so interested in having contact with Peter, that as we once held back, Paul seemed to figure that maybe it wasn't the time, or maybe he wasn't so interested at the moment. So we were always trying to figure out ways of getting more ecumenical conversation and prayer together and common effort. And in the beginning, it was quite difficult, and I think we could say that the initiative mostly came from our side. There was another element. The other factor in this development was the League for Christian Unity, and that's an organization of young, mostly young Lutheran priests, we call them in Sweden, and also laymen. And they were fired by the vision of Vatican II, and they felt that they were a province of the church. They were the local church. And they had developed Christianity in Sweden during those 450 years, and that it was time that they would move into unity with the chair of Peter as a group. That is, they wanted to take the whole Swedish church and bring it as a church in contact again with Rome. And they acknowledge the Bishop of Rome as the leader of the church, and they were going to work for this corporate reunion. That was their idea, is, and their vision was to have corporate reunion, and not to go in and capitulate to Rome, but to take with them all their rich spiritual tradition and to share that and enrich the Church of Rome. Well, these people, they started out, they were not a big group, but they had tremendous contact with the communications media, and they had a great deal of impact, and they stimulated. They stimulated discussion and effort, because anything, they came out so drastically and emphatically that everyone else kind of came part way, just as not to be standing still. So I think those were the two big factors. 1968, there was in Sweden the General Assembly, Fourth General Assembly of the World Council of Churches. And up to that time, there had not been a whole lot yet that happened in Sweden. There were efforts here and there that we had started and that the League for Christian Unity had inspired, but there was not a whole lot. And then in Sweden, they were beginning to worry. The Archdiocese called a meeting. I remember that I was at that, and we
had a series of meetings as to what could be done in Sweden to prepare for the World Council, because they said, we're experts on the world level, but at home we don't have anything. And this is going to be one of the big themes of the World Council of Churches, particularly the new relation between the World Council and the Catholic Church in the light of Vatican II. That's going to have its impact. The World Council is going to have to take some kind of stand now to what Vatican II has done. And so there was some discussion as what could be done at home so they would have something to show. So there was more effort then before the World Council. And then after the World Council, much was promised, but very little seemed to happen. Many people were quite unhappy. Even there were kind of critical voices from every part, every church, that things were so stagnant after the World Council meeting, because then they thought everything was going to develop very rapidly. I think then, because of this criticism in the wake of the World Council meeting at Uppsala, gradually people began to see that something had to be done. And so 1972, this last year, has really been the turning point. In Sweden, there is what is called the Swedish Ecumenical Council. It's a national body as the World Council of Churches. And the Catholic Church was not a member. And in 1972, early in the year, the Catholic Church was invited to be a full member. By that time, it was thought safe to invite the Catholic Church in, and the Church was happy. Actually, we were working for the possibility of being a member already from 1966. So this was a big thing, because there are many commissions in this Swedish Ecumenical Council. There's one for faith and order, and there's one for justice and peace and development, and there's one for local ecumenism. And now we're in all those committees. We have Catholics in all of those committees, the Orthodox also. And that means that this Swedish Council of Churches reflects much better the church situation in Sweden. And we all have this organ. It's a bureaucratic organ, but it gives us a structure with which to make our contacts very regular and thorough and all-embracing. So this was certainly a great factor. The second factor that made 1972 a turning point was the national ecumenical meeting of all the churches in Gothenburg, called G72. This was organized by this ecumenical council. We'd never had a national ecumenical meeting, and so now all the churches were invited in proportion to their membership. And the Catholics were allowed 40 delegates. And there were 2,000 delegates in all that met from August 9th to 13th in Gothenburg. It had been prepared thoroughly for about 2 years, and there were Catholics and Orthodox also in the preparation, as well as the churches that are made up of Swedes, only Swedes, exclusively of Swedes. The theme for this was community, communion, or enmity. And that was the idea. We would meet together to pray, to celebrate the unity we have, and then to discuss in groups, under different aspects, this general theme of community or enmity. And there were four basic themes in that: community or enmity between people and the church, any church. And by taking such a problem, we could see that all the churches really have the same basic problem, that how far does the church go in reaching into the lives of people? How does the church really relate to people seeking, whether consciously or unconsciously, after the Lord and His message and His life? And then there was enmity or community among the churches. That was the second facet of the discussion. So first the church, each church and people, and then among the churches, between the churches. And thirdly, between the church and minorities in Sweden, in particular the immigrants. And there, of course, the Orthodox and we had a lot to say because we're cultural, ethnic, and religious minorities. How well are they accepted? What can we do to help? And finally, the fourth, enmity or communion, community, between the church or churches in Sweden and especially the developing countries, the international problems of our world. What could we do? So by taking such themes, really, we could see that there was a tremendous ground that we had in common, that we really met as a family. And it was a great moment there, the opening of that meeting in Gothenburg. We came to the church, and we couldn't get in. The church was packed. It was the Cathedral of Gothenburg, and there were more people outside of the church, large as it was, than were inside. That doesn't happen too often in Sweden. And it was just a good thing that we could see that there are a lot of people that believe in this country, and a lot of people that really, really are interested. And it made a very good impression on the country. And then to see this panorama, as it were, of church leaders. You could see the leaders of the state church and of the free churches and of the Orthodox and the Catholics, see them all going in, and the different ministers and the people, and all singing together and praying together. It was really, really something wonderful. And I think people began to understand in a very concrete, emphatic, dramatic way that we are one, that we're one family, and we're more one than we are separate. That meeting, coupled with the membership in the Swedish Ecumenical Council, marked the turning point. And there was another national meeting in 72, and that was this time not so official, not officially all the churches, but it was a national charismatic meeting, October 10th to 15th in Stockholm. And there again, all the churches participated. What made this so wonderful was that you had the churches that find it very hard to accept the Catholic Church in Sweden, the Pentecostals, very happy with the Catholics. We had a Catholic priest. We had three leaders, David Duplessis from America, Michael Harper from England, and a Father George DePrizio from America, a Catholic priest. And they came and they led these meetings. There was a translator. And the Pentecostals really felt that we're all one because they've got the Spirit, just as we've got the Spirit. And we celebrated that unity we have in spite of everything on the deepest level, the level of the Holy Spirit. And I think that did a great deal, because much of the fear of the state church about contact with the Catholics was that they would alienate the Pentecostals. And now that's no longer true. We'd like to say just a brief word on the future, what is going to happen now. Well, we have this organism that we can work through regularly. We've had two dramatic events, this charismatic meeting on a national level and this official national ecumenical meeting. And so now it seems as though everyone is saying that what has to be done at present is to go to the local community and to make sure that ecumenism grows on the grassroots, that there's where the question lies now. It's not a question of a group of experts or a question of dramatic national events, but to make sure that on the local level, people are praying together and working together, cooperating, and also that they're speaking about what they have in common and also what they have differently from the point of view of what they share. I think some things have really happened. For one thing, I just speak from our community on the local level. We've got to get, the state closed the youth center every Saturday night because the personnel did not want to work on Saturday night, and of course that was when the young people wanted it most. And there is a bad dope problem, narcotic problem in Sweden, as in all industrial societies, and it's very permissive in Sweden, so it is a wealthy country, so it's a big problem. So the churches got together, and all the churches, Pentecostal, Catholic, and state church, and free churches, they're all working together to man these recreation centers so that they will be open Saturday night. And not doing it in the name of one church or the other, but just trying to help these young people out. And I think it's a wonderful experience for us that on the local level we're working together. This has happened in different areas. Another thing that's in the future, that a future direction, is that in the community where we are in Greater Stockholm, we are going to rent a chapel in the new state church. We will have all our services in this chapel, and we'll also rent a little Blessed Sacrament chapel where we will reserve the bread that we believe is the body of Christ. We'll reserve that permanently and also have an officer to meet the people. And so this will be in the same edifice as the Swedish church. They're building one big church and then two chapels, and we'll rent one of the chapels. And in the chapel that we rent, there'll be a pit in the floor for baptism by immersion for the Pentecostals when they want to use it. So I think this is something. Now, one of the big questions in Sweden is separation of church-state. There is a proposition to the parliament right now. The authorities in the state church, the bishops, oppose change. They want to keep the state church. But the young ministers, as a rule, and the young people want separation. And this is going to be very important, because we have to say, I think, right now, that when we have an ecumenical meeting or anything, we're, in many ways, we're not equals, because we have one church that we all pay taxes to, and they have a tremendous financial a possibility and power that the rest of us do not have. And they have a situation, a place in society that the rest of the churches do not have. And so it makes it difficult. There is a tendency to be patronizing in ecumenical work because of that. And it doesn't create a really working as equals. So I think myself, I love the Swedish church, and I would not want to hurt it in any way, but I would think it would be much better were it free from the government. I don't think it would really suffer, and I wouldn't want them to really be hurt. That wouldn't be the reason I would be for separation. So that's going to be a big question in the future. Then this League for Christian Unity always keeps agitating, and if they do nothing else, at least they keep before our eyes the idea that Christ wants one church somehow, that we are one body of Christ, and we must really become that the world might believe, and in particular in Sweden, that people might believe. And they are saying that this idea that there will be one church, and their idea that the local church of Sweden would be joined with the Church of Rome, but keeping all its gifts of the Holy Spirit. This idea, they figure, has to have some kind of forerunner, some kind of model. And so they're thinking in terms of some group that will go before as a bridge. And they themselves profess the Catholic faith, as we profess it, the Roman Catholic faith, we might say, and try to explain how this is in perfect harmony with the intuitions of Martin Luther and with Swedish church tradition. So they profess, this is what they profess, and they want to stay in the Swedish church, however, and they want to stay there and be this bridge. And gradually they want the church to give them jurisdiction, for extraordinary jurisdiction for Catholics, but they would have ordinary jurisdiction in their own church. And then gradually the two would just grow together. But what they have, this is also a thought that's going on in Germany, that there must be some kind of model, some kind of bridge before the churches, which are large, can grow together. This is part of the growing together process. If we really mean what we say, that there's got to be one church, there's got to be some kind of growing together. Now, I don't say that this is the only way, and maybe this is too Catholic-oriented. There are many Catholics that fear this just as much as Protestants, because they say they're coming in, and what are we going to do? They'll be taking over. They're more numerous than we, and some say why they believe more. They will be a conservative element in the church. You know, they feel that they are more strongly attached to Rome than many of our progressive Catholics, and they wonder what this is going to mean. So that it's not just that there are worries on the Protestant side, but there are worries on the Catholic side as well. So, but I think it's good anyhow that there's some kind of concrete effort, and maybe it will stimulate something better.
We're grateful for what you have told us, Father. I think we'd like to know more. And this is your opportunity now to put the questions to Father that will help to give you that additional insight that his exposition is stimulating. Father James.
Father, as a Roman Catholic, how do you find the or evaluate the theological atmosphere of the Swedish Church? Not the separatist groups of the League for Reunion, but I mean the general theological atmosphere within the Church of Sweden. How do you see that from the standpoint of your life beyond?
Well, we had a very difficult situation within the state church. A few years ago, was the naming of the Bishop of Stockholm, Olof Strim. And you see in Sweden what they do, they vote for the bishop. Priests and members of the church, certain number of electors, but that's based on membership in the church, and since membership is the same as citizenship, you can get in different kind of people. So there were three people presented. There are always three presented to the government. And the government chose this particular man. Ingemar Strim is his name. And there was a great deal of controversy when he was named, because he has made many statements that seem problematic about the divinity of Christ and the bodily resurrection of Christ and the virginal conception of Christ. It's not sure, really. It seems like it's very difficult to say what he holds. Well, there was this terrible controversy going on. There were bishops in the state church writing in the daily newspapers. There were two in particular, Bishop Brattgård of Skara and Bishop Jertner of Göteborg. And they said they would not attend his consecration because they did not think that he held these things. They did not have evidence that he held them. And there were TV debates between them and everything. Of course, in Sweden, they're very insistent on freedom from the secular society, from dogmatic influences, so they took the side of Bishop Strim and really gave him very ample time on television. And he's extremely good on television. He's a wonderful man, really, and very interested in bringing Christ to people. But He interprets these things in a very enigmatic way. Well, I think that the key point, then of course many people in the church are excited. They said, well, what do we believe in the church, you know? And many people said, well, we don't have to believe those things, you know? So there was a big discussion within the state church. And the archbishop, at that time it was Josefsson, he's dead now, but he said that the Swedish church has a very high ceiling. And there have always been bishops in our church in history that have denied the divinity of Christ, his bodily resurrection, and his virginal conception. virginal birth, and he hoped that there would always be room for people and bishops to deny those things. And so, now he didn't say what he thought Bishop Strem held. He just said that, made that statement, and he consecrated him. So I think that could maybe give you some idea of the breadth of opinion within the state church, and it's from the mouth of the Archbishop himself. They took a survey recently, and oddly enough, the young people believe more in the divinity of Christ now than the older people, which was a shock to those that believe, you know, that was a kind of a shock to many people, because especially Bishop Strem was very good with young people, but it seemed as for some reason, anyhow, they do.
I've always been interested in the succession. Rome never excommunicated Sweden, did it?
No.
And from a technical point of view, then the Church of Sweden is in the correct succession, apostolic and so forth, because the bishops, lock, stock, and barrel, went over under Gustavus Vasa's pressure. And that's true, isn't it?
Yes, it seems
as
though... That's
why the octave of unity is practiced earlier than anywhere else in Sweden, and has probably more followers to it than does it in January each year. Or didn't you practice the octave of unity?
We practiced two of them. As a matter of fact, we have that one in early January, and then we have the one from the 18th through the 25th.
Oh, in each year, yeah.
Yeah, but I would say they're not too well attended in Sweden. Right after the council, that became quite popular, and it's more of an effort now to get people...
But the succession was never broken.
Succession was never broken, it seems, and that the bishops, there's the chain, the Lutheran bishops were ordained by a Catholic bishop.
That's right.
And so there seems to be a line, there seems to be able to be made a better case for succession
than
the Church of England, yes.
But we always had it this way, that the English were not sure and stressed it very much, and the Swedes were sure to have it, didn't really care.
Yes. Now that's generally what I think the traditional thought is, that they have it and they don't overstress its significance. I'd say that.
What sort of tensions, if any, are there within the state church of Sweden itself? Like a few years back there was rather strong tensions between the confessional wing of the church, represented by certain members of the Diocese of Gothenburg and the high, so-called high church wing and the pietist wing of the church. Are these tensions still existent and are they very powerful? It seems to me that there is some evidence, at least, that they exert some influence in the establishment, for example, of the free faculty recently in Sweden.
I would say the major tension within the church is between those who want to keep the state church, and they say they want an open church and a church that doesn't demand anything from the Christian, that gives the grace, that offers the grace of Christ and doesn't demand anything. And they interpret these statistics of baptisms, confirmations, marriages, and burials in the church, they interpret them as signs of the great faith in the country. Then you have the high church movement with its different ramifications, and they generally stress that there's not too much faith in Sweden, that those are just statistics that are diminishing, and that it's not sufficient that the church offer grace, but the people themselves must have a living faith, and there must be one must proclaim a doctrine to believe. One must proclaim the message of Christ as interpreted by the three councils, by the three creeds, Nicaea, Apostles' Creed, Nicaea, and Athanasius, and then also the Augustana. And then they would say that it's very important to have the Eucharistic service, that they would have nattvard is the word they used in Sweden, but that you have communion, that the state church stresses much more preaching, what they call high mass without communion. It's like our four mass, or the service of the word. And in many churches in Sweden, they do not have a mass where one can go to communion on a Sunday. There's no opportunity. Whereas the high church people, they want that. And they want to insist, they say better to have a smaller group of believers. So that's kind of the tension, whether to have this large church, which in a sense is dependent on their relationship to the state, or to have a small church of believers and a church that would also insist on sacramental life. So I think that's the fundamental tension. There are different variations and nuances there.
This does refer to ecumenism, but do you find any hopeful signs? We're always given Sweden as the case of a society that has left God. Are there any signs of return to God?
Well, I think Sweden, in a sense, probably is might show us where the world is heading religiously. That it is an industrial society and a democratic society and secularistic. And so that people, that most people are really not against Christ, but they're not for him, they're neutral. And they don't want to take a stand, it's like that. And there are very few people that are really against religion, but there are not too many people that are for it. So I think that's true to say. I think the Swedes myself have kind of a religious temperament. They love nature, you know, to stand in front of a sunset or to walk in the forest, you know, they love that, and they kind of commune with some power when they do that. They silence, you know, like a Bergman movie. So I think they do have kind of a natural religious tendency. I think they have a great need for religion. That right now, the big crisis is the reason to live, you know, a meaning in life in Sweden. That there is no social problem in Sweden. I think you could say that there's no real poverty, and people that are sick, they're cared for. People have adequate housing, and there are no slums in Sweden. So they've really done marvelous things. Of course, it's a small population, it's rather homogenous, and they control the influx. It's not so hard for them to have achieved that, but it is a marvelous achievement. But solving that economic and social problem, they still have a very great and pronounced human and religious problem. And these themes of Swedish movies, you know, boredom and sadness and loneliness, this pervades Swedish life, and meaninglessness to life. So that I think they really need Christ and his Spirit and his church. And we would like to share it. I can't say that we're doing so well. Like to share it with them as much as we can. But there are great signs of life in the state church. I think many of these priests are really holy and creative and imaginative. They seem to be held down by the fact of being joined to the state. And it also casts kind of a bad glow on religion in the eyes of many people, too. They have a department of religion, a department of the state church in the cabinet. There's a minister who's a woman in this case, a wonderful woman, but who is a member of the church and says she's not a believer. But so she's naming the bishops, of course. And she's really a good person, wants to help the church in that, you know, but this is all known to the people. It's they're always on TV, you know. So I think it gives the church a bad image in people's eyes.
Father Deitz, what comes across to you, from the United States, as you look back in the United States from where you are, and for instance this year, the movement is the Key 73 movement here. There have been other movements too, but what, we're in it. I mean, I know what somewhat what's going on, but I'm just curious, I guess, and how, say, Sweden, the church, the work you're doing there, would view anything that's happening in the United States, in any local area or somewhere, I've got an ecumenical movement here.
What I would find most fascinating, I think what people in Europe would find most fascinating from that I would read about America right now would be the movement toward meditation. That there seems to be the prayer movement, you might say. On the one hand, the quiet prayer, the prayer of meditation, and on the other hand, the charismatic prayer, the prayer meetings and the speaking in tongues and praying in tongues and all that. I think those two things, this going back to prayer and faith, you know, in the wake of the council and the events of Vietnam and everything, there was people became very theological discussing the doctrine, and they also became very political. And I think what has happened now is that they're affirming more of their faith, and they're praying more. Just hope that they would still keep the political involvement to transform the world, to make it more human and Christian, not, you know, completely losing that insight and gift that they had. But I would say that's how America comes across the ocean as they would see it. And America really influences Sweden and Europe. What happens here, of course, and especially among the young, that certainly influences Europe. We have it a little bit later than you do, and we have like these Jesus people from America. They come to Sweden, and many of the charismatic leaders come, and we read about these different efforts at meditation. And so there's kind of a love-hate relationship, I think, between Europe and America, and Sweden and America in particular, that they're, in a sense, they're always trying to show that they're independent and that they're superior, and yet they really do take these movements from America and adapt them. But I think that the impulse in these things has come really more from America right now. I think they would like the charismatic movement. I don't think there's much doubt on that. That really comes from this country. I don't know if that's what you were out after.
I'm just wondering, you know, because I haven't been in the St. Louis area that long myself to say it, but it seemed to me that there had been a move also away from just a hierarchical movement or any kind of exchange going on there. It's spreading out more locally, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
Rather than kind of bishops here, you know, in the
ecumenical. I think there's less interest in the institution or church, no matter what church it is, and less interested in the leaders. I don't think people are, after Vatican II, I think within our own church, we were more awed and people were more involved in reforming the hierarchy and thinking that that was going to mean more than it actually would and could. And then I think what the charismatic movement did anyhow reminded them that the structure is one thing, but the deepest level is life and prayer and faith and witness and mission and involvement. And that's something that every person has. Each one has his gift, so it's up to each person to get fired by the Spirit and work together with the whole body. So I think it's a profounder vision of the church. It's not just the leadership that we're all in this, and each of us has his gift, and the Spirit's breathing and blowing in each of us.
It's been a wonderful evening. Thank you so much,
Father. Well, we're deeply grateful to you, Father, for having come and for having shared your experiences with us. You have quite a group here of people from all over, and what you've said should resonate in ever-widening circles. We're deeply grateful. Are you going back this week?
Oh, yes.
When?
I'll be going back at the... I'll be leaving America in the middle of May, but I'm going to Rome first, and then I'll be going back at the, I would say, toward the end of June. I've been there 9 years, just about.